This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 24, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll take a look at the government's plans for a worker database in the immigration bill. Community organizations say they intend to sue the Department of Energy for violations at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. And South Central farmers call a red alert after a court orders their eviction. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The Senate Intelligence Committee has endorsed General Michael Hayden to become the new director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The three Democrats who voted against him cited concerns over the warrantless wiretapping domestic surveillance program that began during Hayden's leadership of the National Security Agency. The full Senate is expected to meet for his confirmation hearing tomorrow. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union announced today that chapters in 20 states are filing complaints with state regulators regarding recent reports of NSA access to the phone records of millions of Americans. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
The ACLU says they are reacting to the two major news stories that have been published in the past 5 months about domestic surveillance. Howard Simon is executive director with the Florida ACLU. He said his group has filed a complaint and request for information for several telephone companies with the Florida Public Service Commission. Simon says that on the face of it, the telephone companies named in the USA Today report have broken Florida law, as he mentioned a specific state statute,
which essentially makes it a misdemeanor with a $25,000 a day violation for the divulgence of customer records unless authorized by customers or required by some legal process.
In Massachusetts, four different mayors are mentioned in complaints sent to the state agency regarding telecommunications. Michael Bissonnette is mayor of Chicopee, Massachusetts.
Unfortunately, we've gone from "Can you hear me now?" to "Who can hear me now?"
On Tuesday, the Federal Communications Commission declined to investigate whether the NSA had access to millions of Americans' telephone records, citing the secrecy of the National Security Agency. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
A New York jury is deliberating the outcome of a trial of a Pakistani immigrant accused of plotting to blow up Herald Square. Rebecca Miles reports from New York City.
Closing arguments have concluded in the trial of 23-year-old Shaobhawa Martin Siraj. The Pakistani immigrant is charged with conspiracy to bomb Herald Square subway, a dense shopping district in Manhattan. Siraj was arrested on the eve of the Republican National Convention in 2004. The defense has argued an undercover informant paid by the NYPD used techniques of entrapment to involve Siraj in a conspiracy. The jury learned that the Egyptian-born police informant made friends with the accused and secretly recorded more than 30 hours of conversations. The defense attorney has argued the U.S. government manufactured the crime, explaining the informant ingratiated himself with the young man and inflamed his political passions with pictures from Abu Ghraib and talk of abuse of Muslims in America and in the Middle East. The prosecution has argued that while everyone is entitled to their political opinions, talk of placing a bomb in a crowded subway system does not qualify as protected free speech. If convicted of conspiracy, Siraj could face 20 years in prison. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting from New York.
In Chile, four Mapuche Indians sentenced to 10 years in prison and ordered to pay nearly $900,000 for an arson campaign are on hunger strike once again. This comes shortly after ending a hunger strike of more than 60 days. In Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has the story.
Senators who broker a legislative agreement with the government that would allow the four Mapuches to serve their sentences at a halfway house say the new hunger strike endangers the legislation that would benefit them. This weekend, the Mapuches took up their hunger strike for the second time after a parliamentary commission studying the bill recessed for 30 days. The previous hunger strike ended when Congress agreed to consider emergency legislation that would allow the Mapuches to serve their sentences at a halfway house. The Mapuches say they're innocent. They were tried under a Pinochet-era anti-terrorism act for the forest fires set in lands historically controlled by the Mapuches. But today, the government says the emergency legislation period expired as Congress is on recess until June 6. It is not clear what will happen to the hunger strike and the emergency legislation. A Catholic bishop who helped broker the deal walked away from the agreement today. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh chaired a roundtable conference on Kashmir in Srinagar today. The first roundtable conference was held in New Delhi in February of this year. Shahnawaz Khan reports.
Like the first roundtable conference, Kashmiri separatist groups stayed away from the conference, calling it futile. The moderate faction of the separatist Alliance Huriyat conference had reservations about some people invited to the roundtable talks by Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. Of the 41 invitees, only 30 attended. A general strike called by the hardline faction of Huriyat conference paralyzed normal life in Kashmir today. Guerrillas struck at four places in Srinagar in spite of heavy security arrangements. Although the roundtable conference was the first of its kind, in which an Indian Prime Minister visited Kashmir to discuss Kashmir issue itself, the non-participation of separatist leaders diminished its importance. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
And in Fort Benning, Georgia, the nation's first female conscientious objector has been sentenced to 120 days of confinement for refusing deployment to Afghanistan. Army National Guard Specialist Catherine Jashinsky applied for a discharge 18 months ago, but was denied and later court-martialed for refusing to train with weapons. Jashinsky says that at the end of her sentence, she will resume her studies at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate is poised to vote on their entire immigration bill tomorrow, a worker verification program to verify that workers are lawfully working in the United States will be included in the bill. The program would create a database of all new employees hired, which concerns privacy rights groups who say this is just one more government database that could be abused. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
A main reason immigrants come to the United States is to work. To deter employers who hire undocumented immigrants, the Senate established a national system to verify all workers, not just immigrants. Employers will have to add the name, date of birth, social security number, or immigrant number, and state or country of origin into a national database. The database is supposed to confirm if the person is a lawful resident and they are who they say they are. An employer who is caught hiring three or more undocumented immigrants can be fined up to $20,000 per person. If an employee is deemed fraudulent, they have 9 days to appeal. If they win, they will receive back pay if the court agrees. The Senate authorized $400 million to implement this program. Proponents hope this will expunge the use of fraudulent documents and Social Security numbers. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California.
False identity documents are really a no-no in our society. It's the way a society can protect itself. It's a way people are known for who they are, not somebody else.
But rights groups have privacy concerns. Although a last-minute safeguard was added that prohibits the use of the database for any reasons other than the law allows, Gregory Nosheim with the American Civil Liberties Union says the opportunity for identity theft increases with just another database that contains personal information.
Once that system is created, there will inevitably be mission creep, and that more and more uses for that information will be found to the detriment of the privacy of every working person in the country.
This is not the last word, and yes, there'll be additional privacy issues for us to look at.
That was Democratic Senator from Oregon, Ron Wyden. He said he needed to review them before he spoke about other privacy issues. Further technology is being proposed to simplify the worker verification system. The Verichip Corporation says they have technology that could stop fraudulent activity. It's an implanted radio frequency ID. John Proctor is a spokesperson for Verichip.
Human implantable RFID chip. It's about the size of a grain of rice. The device uses passive RFID technology to communicate a unique 16-digit identification number. That number is then linked to a secure database.
Currently, the chip is used in several hospitals to access a patient's medical records on a computer database. But privacy rights groups say the radio frequency that transmits the information is too easily accessible. Again, Gregory Nosheim with the ACLU.
RFID chips create enormous security problems and privacy problems because under many of the proposals, it's difficult or impossible for the person who possesses a document with the chip to ensure that it isn't constantly broadcasting personal information about them.
John Proctor says the VeriChip can't be read more than 6 inches away. Technology will be relied upon heavily to implement many provisions of the immigration bill if it is to pass. A final vote will take place in the Senate tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Iraqi Oil Ministry's Inspector General reports this week that $1 billion of Iraq's oil is being illegally smuggled out of the country every month. Smuggling on such a large scale, coupled with increasing violence and the lack of basic services like water and electricity, have caused increasing tensions in the southern oil city of Basra. Over 100 civilians have been killed in Basra so far this month. Residents there are pointing the finger at the governor and the British military, which occupies the city. FSRN's Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib have more.
Before the recent spate of killings, Basra had a reputation as one of the most peaceful cities in occupied Iraq. The British military, whose 8,000 soldiers control Basra, were considered by many to be more humane than their American counterparts. But when thousands of residents took to the streets earlier this month to protest high unemployment and corruption in the governor's office, the British attacked the demonstration with helicopters. Fighters responded. Asad Karim is president of the Iraqi Oil Workers Union in Basra.
They shot down the helicopter. It was real resistance. They shot it down because the British were supporting the governor and shooting at the people at the demonstration. And the governor didn't stop the British from bombing the demonstration, and so that's his responsibility also.
Amjad Ali al-Jawahari is North American representative of the Iraqi trade union movement. He told FSRN frustration had been building in Basra before the violence broke out.
I visited Basra last year, and I've seen that the piles or mountains of garbage in the city, sewage system is destroyed, water system is not adequate, even clean water is not there, electricity is not up to the expectation. It was at that time, it was you were getting 3 hours a day. Today you're getting 30 minutes or an hour a day, which is way worse than before.
Oil Workers Union President Asad Karim adds the lack of water and electricity aren't the only reasons for rising tensions.
The government in Baghdad was giving a lot of support and money to Basra, but the governor was misusing it, and that led to a lot of violence and a lot of strikes, including walkouts by the military and police. The governor didn't improve security. The security in Basra is so bad. The unemployment is high, and there is corruption in his administration. He's not obeying the laws of the central government.
So far, at least 7 British soldiers and 100 Iraqi civilians are dead in the fighting. Fadl Ashara, the spokesman for the Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr, says British forces and the governor want to blame the killings on sectarian conflict, but he says that's not so.
What happened in Basra is that Ayatollah al-Sistani's representative talked about the corruption created by the governor and his administration, which caused the governor to say that the religious offices were responsible for all the violence in Basra, and that we are dividing people against themselves. I think that as the Sadr movement, this kind of language is not responsible. They should be more responsible in their proclamations. Now, the problem has been solved by the Sadr office. We sent our representative to Basra and we held a meeting of the two groups to try to solve the problem peacefully.
But clashes with the governor's office are not the only cause of violence in Basra. The National Association of Sunni Clergymen, the Association of Muslim Scholars, complained this week that 1,200 Sunni Arab families from the oil city have been forced out. Iraq's North American Trade Union representative, Amjad Ali al-Jawahari.
They are getting killed and they are getting abducted every day, on a daily basis. So many people are getting, abducted from that area. Just recently, 18 people were abducted and they found them dead somewhere else. Head of one of the tribes was killed and the people from Al-Zubayr attacked the police station. They killed 6 or 7 policemen from the city. The governing council, who are predominantly Shia, try to get rid of the Sunnis from there, and the Sunnis want to, strike back.
Amidst all of this, the Prime Minister of Denmark, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, paid a visit to Basra today. Denmark has 535 troops stationed in Basra. As part of his visit, the Danish Premier announced he'll be bringing some of those troops home starting in July. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
While the permanent members of the UN Security Council met today to discuss what action to take over Iran's nuclear program, exiled Iranians from the country's pro-democracy movement demonstrated against military action in Iran and for comprehensive sanctions. Naomi Fowler reports from outside the British Foreign Office in London.
Import sanctions!
Iranians here today say that if economic and political sanctions had been imposed on Iran by the international community, instead of a policy of appeasement over the last 25 years, a popular uprising against the Iranian regime could have taken place much sooner.
People of Iran have suffered greatly in the last 25 years. All people you see here, they are all victims. Everybody has lost somebody. I've lost my husband. They are here to send a message to the foreign ministers, to the West, that enough is enough.
Iranian pro-democracy supporter Leila Jazayeri.
They should boycott this regime internationally, diplomatic, trade, economic sanction at the UN, side with millions of Iranian people, with the victims, not the perpetrators, not those who are executing minors, who are publicly hanging women for adultery. Let us bring about change ourselves. That's all we are asking. We don't want any financial support. We want change. We are frustrated. We are fed up with the Western's attitude. Years of conciliatory approach and appeasement led us where we are now.
Nasser Razi of the National Council of Resistance of Iran believes past policies by the West towards Iran have been economically motivated.
Iran is one of the biggest oil producers, and they have made lucrative deals with the Iranian regime, France, the Total company, Renault, and all the big companies all over the world. They are benefiting from this. The most effective is the oil embargo on the Iranian regime. Iranian people have been under sanctions for the past 27 years. More than 80% of the Iranian people are living below the poverty line. These are the official figures from the Iranian regime. So the sanctions wouldn't hurt the Iranian people. And even if it hurts, Iranian people are willing to put up with it. As we can hear from the demonstrators, they say no appeasement and no war, because Iranian people are well capable of bringing about the democratic change in Iran. Iran has got a nationwide democratic opposition which has been active during the past 27 years inside Iran and outside Iran.
The National Council for Resistance in Iran, which has support from members of the European Parliament, many high-profile human rights barristers, jurists and parliamentarians, delivered a resolution with their demands today to the British Foreign Secretary. This is Naomi Fowler outside London's Foreign and Commonwealth Office for Free Speech Radio News.
As the U.S. Senate is scheduled to vote next month on a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, a group of clergy representing various religious traditions are calling on senators to say no to the marriage ban. They believe such an amendment would endanger religious liberty and compromise civil rights. Yanmei Shea has the story from Washington, D.C.
Representatives of Clergy for Fairness is a coalition of different religious voices. It organized more than 1,600 faith community representatives to sign a petition against the amendment banning gay marriage. As part of their petition drive, several dozen clergy members are on Capitol Hill this week, asking senators to vote against the proposal. Dr. Paul Simmons is an ordained Baptist minister in Louisville, Kentucky. He says such a constitutional amendment smacks of Puritanism and threatens the fundamental value of the separation of church and state.
Puritanism seems never to die. It lives always to try to deprive others of the spirit of freedom and of their own free exercise of rights before and with God. They use religious liberty as a way to camouflage bigotry in the name of God.
The Senate Judiciary Committee passed the Federal Marriage Amendment last week by a vote divided along party lines. Committee Chairman, Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter, said he was against the marriage amendment, but believed it deserves a full Senate debate. Bishop Joe Doss says the definition of marriage goes into the heart of theology and should be actively debated, just not in the Senate.
The place that you debate these kinds of theological issues is in the councils of the church, supported by the seminaries and places of learning, and our churches, synagogues, and houses of worship.
Dr. Kenneth Samuel is an African-American Baptist minister from Atlanta. He reminded people that it was not until 1948 that California struck down the law banning interracial marriage. And now, he says, same-sex couples are in a similar battle for their civil rights.
To discriminate against a class of people is wrong, because a threat to justice anywhere is still a threat to justice everywhere.
Maggie Gallagher, president of the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy, however, opposes categorizing same-sex marriage as a civil rights struggle.
Once a court goes to rule gay marriage is a civil right, that people who have an older conjugal vision of marriage as inherently the union of husband and wife are going to be treated like racists in the public square.
Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist has scheduled a vote on the proposed amendment the week of June the 5th. Most believe it stands little chance of passing. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
According to a coalition of community organizations in northern New Mexico, the Los Alamos National Laboratory is violating regulations of the Clean Water Act. The group intends to sue the Department of Energy and regents of the University of California who managed the lab. They are demanding that the lab honor its agreement to clean up the pollution and stop creating more contaminants that are making their way to the Rio Grande. Leslie Clark has more.
The group chose a site next to the Rio Grande to announce their intent to sue the DOE and the University of California. Kathy Sanchez of Tewa Women United is a member of San Ildefonso Pueblo. She says the people of her pueblo, which is adjacent to Los Alamos National Lab, are suffering from 60 years of contamination coming from the lab.
We cannot fish. There's been a protection order or a limit on the amount of fish that you can eat. Our animals that we harvest up there that are sacred to us have a lot of lesions or have a lot of illnesses.
The coalition contends the contaminants from more than 1,400 documented sites at the lab are threatening public health. Many people at San Ildefonso Pueblo, according to Sanchez, are ill from exposure to the toxins dumped at the lab and contaminants released during the Cerro Grande fire in 2000.
So we have a lot of the cancers, the illnesses, and there's a lot of asthma, and there's that fire that happened up there, and we've been inhaling the contaminants that have been airborne, but we're also talking about the water and the water that we drink.
The coalition referred to studies by Los Alamos National Lab and the New Mexico Environment Department showing millions of gallons of liquid radioactive waste and hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive materials dumped by the lab from as far back as 1943 are migrating towards the river. The group's attorney, Matthew Bishop, warns the future drinking water supply for Santa Fe and Albuquerque are also at risk.
We're seeing high levels of contaminants, primarily PCBs, chromium, and high explosives that are emerging in the surface waters and along the soils of the various canyons. And as you can see from the map here, all of these canyons flow into the Rio Grande, which is really the lifeblood of the state of New Mexico, an extremely important river and water body, not only for the local farmers and fishermen, but also for the urban areas.
The DOE's proposed budget for 2007 indicates a $90 million shortfall for cleanup of the contaminated sites. The coalition suggests using money from potential fines levied on the lab because of its failure to comply with the Clean Water Act, according to Joni Ahrens of Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety.
Our preliminary estimates are that there are billions of dollars in fines, potential fines, as a result of not reporting, not monitoring, and then the unauthorized discharges as well over these sites towards the river.
The coalition wants the lab to implement best practices for discharges and dumping, and the group hopes a lawsuit will compel Los Alamos National Lab to clean up legacy waste and stop creating more, so the Rio Grande can continue to support the ecosystem along its path. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
The South Central farmers have called a red alert and are asking supporters to take a principled stance to help the nation's largest urban farm. The farmers and their supporters have established an encampment on the 14-acre green space to resist a sheriff's eviction ordered by the court. The farmers were unable to secure the over $16 million demanded by developer Ralph Horowitz to save the farm. Joan Baez, Daryl Hannah, and Julia Butterfly Hill have joined in the call to pressure L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa to intervene on behalf of the South Central Farm, which feeds roughly 350 families. Christina Onestad reports.
Unable to raise the $10 million more needed to buy the South Central Farm, farmers and community activists are camping out and refusing to leave. Tezo Zomok is the elected leader of the South Central Farmers.
Mayor Villaraigosa states that he supports this issue, but he said that he had given up on raising the remaining $10 million that was necessary to purchase this land. And on that same day, the city council and the mayor, of course, were able to find $800 million to renovate a stadium, but they can't find $10 million. And what we're saying to the mayor is that he can't give up that easy, that we need to work together to reach out to the community. This is the beginning of something larger. We're calling out to all our supporters. We're going to camp here. And we're going to take a principled stand for a livable city.
In the middle of an industrial area, the 14-acre urban farm feeds over 350 families. But owner Ralph Horowitz plans to demolish the farm and build warehouses. Some community activists say the farm will become a Walmart. Lisa Albina has been growing food at the South Central Farm since it began over 13 years ago.
No queremos bodegas.
We don't want warehouses. We want to be able to plant cabbage, nopales, all kinds of vegetables. We have to struggle here as much as we can to see if they let us stay, because there are a lot of people that have been here struggling just so that we can save this little space. Community members and activists are calling on the developer to sell the land for the price he bought it for at $5 million from the city, instead of the $16.5 million he is asking from the farmers. Among those calling on the city to save the South Central Farm were folk singer and activist Joan Baez, actress Daryl Hannah, and activist Julia Butterfly Hill, who has started a tree sit at the farm. Daryl Hannah and Julia Butterfly Hill.
I'd like to put a call out to that developer to swallow his greed, and also a call out to the mayor to fulfill his promise to come and help save this farm.
This community farm represents a community that's growing. Every day I'm on the phone calling new people, and new people are coming. So I hope those who want this place destroyed are listening. This isn't getting smaller, it's getting bigger.
Farmers and community members refuse to leave the South Central Farm without a struggle. Reporting for FSRN from the South Central Farm, I'm Christina Onestad.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Washington editor is Leon Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and McMillan. Special thanks today to KPFK program director Armando Gudinho. You can find archives of our newscasts and documentaries online at www.fsrn.org. You can also email us your questions, comments, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.